And welcome to another episode of Hank Unplugged. Remember, this is not my broadcast, this is my podcast. And I have promised people that I would bring them the most interesting, informative podcast you could possibly imagine. And today is no exception. Today I welcome a friend who is a leader in the intelligent design movement. He is a PhD of philosophy of biology from the University of Chicago. He's currently a fellow of the Discovery Institute. He's a professor in the Master of Arts program in science and religion at Biola University. And he has made contributions to films that I have been recommending and really hyperventilating over for quite some time, films produced by Illustra Media. And there are so many of them, and I just love all of them. I remember watching a film called Metamorphosis, and it was one of those transformational films. You have a little caterpillar, and that caterpillar turns into a butterfly, but the process is enormously informative. You know, it sows the seeds of its own demise, a chrysalis, if you will, and there its constituent parts devolve into this mysterious molecular mixture, and out of this comes a brand new being, the same physical being, but different organizationally. Now you have wings. Formerly, there were eyes that could only discern between light and dark, and now a field of vision and color acuity that exceeds even that of a human being. And all of a sudden, you have a proboscis that indulges in the nectar of life. You have a creature that is simply unbelievable. And you watch this unfold in the film, and Dr. Paul Nelson is a big part, the major part of the film, and you think, without any preaching, there has to be a God. These films have been transformational to so many people, and Paul, I am so excited to have you on this podcast.
Well, I'm thrilled to be here. I always love talking to you.
You know, you have been, as I mentioned in the opening of the podcast, a contributor to Illustra Media. And these films, I've hyperventilated over them for a long time. I try to show them to everyone I possibly can, because what I love about these films and your particular contribution to these films is they don't preach. I mean, all the heavy lifting is just done by the content itself.
You know, it's a remarkable fact that the world that God made, if we give it half a chance, testifies unmistakably to his existence, to his authorship, to his creativity, even to his sense of humor. No one can watch a juvenile giant panda gamboling around its pen, you know, without saying whoever made that had a sense of humor. And I was once told by a biologist at University of Chicago, Jim Shapiro, he's a non-Darwinian evolutionist there, he said, Paul, what you guys need to do, and what he meant by you guys was the intelligent design community, he said, just get out of the way of the evidence. You know, you don't even really need to make an argument. Just let the data speak for themselves. And I think that's what the Illustra movies do.
It's interesting when you look at the Darwinian it is a juggernaut. But that juggernaut, seems to me, could not have arisen in the 21st century for so many reasons. One of the reasons I think of is the fact that in the 19th century, you had the blush of the Enlightenment. People were thinking everything was progressing forward in a wonderful way. People were talking about how the average human being would be an Aristotle or a Plato, that the intelligence quota would continue to rise. And so there was this real feeling of euphoria about the evolutionary idea of progress. In the 21st century, now you have people saying that humanity is the greatest blight on the face of the earth. In other words, evolution has sowed the seeds of its own demise through humanity.
Not only that, but what we have learned through the 20th century and now into the 21st about the material basis of life. I mean, I think life ultimately is an immaterial phenomenon. but it does have material components. And at Darwin's time, and really up until the middle of the 20th century, the cell was a mystery. And that mystery, because science does accumulate knowledge, that mystery has been illuminated. And what we find in even the simplest bacterial cell is a universe of complexity beyond imagining. Such that I think you're right, if you do the sort of historical counterfactual and ask, you know, could Darwin have proposed his theory in July 2017? And I think the answer would be no, because the target of explanation is so unbelievably complex. For Darwin, it was a bag of protoplasm. He didn't use that term. That was coined by Huxley. But they thought of it as a kind of a living jelly, very close to non-living chemicals. That worldview is gone. So we inhabit a different universe. The problem is, in the middle of the 19th century, the view of naturalism came to dominate scientific explanation, and we still inhabit that universe, where to count as scientific, an explanation must be rendered strictly in terms of natural processes and chance. And that's far too limited a toolkit to explain the world that we see.
You know, before we get too far into this discussion, I want to talk about this on a personal level. I mean, I have 12 children. I believe you have two daughters. And
yes, yeah.
There's this sense in which all of this, for you and I, is taken personally, because how one views their origins ultimately will determine how they live their life. And this has a great impact on our families.
Oh, it does. And I think that the despair that many young people feel, that is manifested in drug abuse, sexual problems, even suicide, comes in large measure, not entirely, but in large measure from feeling, I have no value. I'm a piece of cosmic dust. The view that really is preached to them by sort of the high priests of new atheism, and in fact, they have infinite value. Each of them, the term I like is an artist proof. You know, when an artist is casting a series, like a series of sculptures, all from the same mold, he makes an artist proof to check that the mold is doing what he wants it to do. And then he'll make more of the same thing. That's not what God does. We're all artist proofs, and then he breaks the mold and starts over again. So each of us is unique. Each of us has infinite value. And the worldview that is promulgated by naturalism tells young people, you don't have any value other than your biological existence, which, if you're lucky, will come to an end in 75 to 80 years. That's not true. Flat out, that's a lie. And so, Hank, I completely agree with you that to restore the dignity of each human being, we need to restore the worldview that says you are of infinite value, created in God's own image.
You know, the debate going all the way back to, I think, 1860 between Thomas Huxley and a bishop named Samuel Wilberforce.
Yep.
By the way, he was the son of the great William.
Quite a family.
Wilberforce, yeah. I mean, incredible family. But he had this debate, and I think it represented the initial stages of the conflict that was at least perceived to exist between science and reason. And that perceived conflict has permeated our thinking through that time, from that time, and I think it was back 19, right a year, I think, the debate was after The Origin of Species actually mm-hmm. came out. That debate, that idea, has permeated bastions of learning ever since, and it still exists today. It's a canard, and it has been a modern conceit that has been continued on in the present, and it is, I think, maybe one of the great canards that has to be exposed.
Yes, I agree, and I think that its roots lie in a philosophy that says the physical world explains itself. In effect, it makes an idol of physical or material reality. Now, Christians, you know, are not called on to deny physical reality, as a Gnostic might. Rather, physical reality, material reality, is part of God's creation. The regularities that he made, the physical laws that he made, are part of his creation. You know, the Apostle Paul in the book of Acts, when he's arguing with pagan philosophers, his example of God's providence and design is the regularity of the seasons. In the ancient Near East, it was a live possibility that you could starve to death if you didn't get rain in the spring for your crops and so forth. So Paul points to the regularity of the seasons, and he says this is God's evidence of God's authorship. So while we are called on to affirm the createdness, the beauty of physical reality, we do not raise it to the status of an idol. It does not explain itself. But once you accept a materialist worldview, then something like neo-Darwinian evolution follows more or less immediately, because you have to have something to build the obvious complexity of living things. And when I've been in this debate for 30 years, and the longer I'm in it, the more I see the real challenge is at this foundational level of getting people, starting with Christians, but getting the culture at large to see that scientific explanation, properly understood, is not or has never been married to materialism. That Galileo would have rejected that view. Newton would have rejected that view. Darwin himself, as a young man, would have rejected that view. So if we can get people to see that science has a broader and richer explanatory, I call it a toolkit, it's what you call on when you face a mystery in the universe, and part of that is design, the reality of causation by a mind, then I think we have a hope of getting science back on track.
I think what's important, and you personify this as well as anyone I've ever met, what's important is tone, how we engage this particular debate. Someone like yourself has a tremendous toolkit, a tremendous reservoir of knowledge, and you can use that knowledge as a hammer to pound people over the head, to expose them through ridicule, or you can try to reach them. So talk for a moment about the difference between repelling people because of the attitude you have. And many apologists do this. I mean, they get a little of knowledge and they want to use that as a hammer. The difference between reaching and repelling.
You know, I think you can find your best insight on this point in how would I like to be treated? Put yourself in the shoes of the person you're talking to. Would I want to be challenged and ridiculed in a way that made me feel inferior or that humiliated me? No. I would want someone to engage me on a level playing field in a friendly, loving way and say, hey, let's sit down and talk about this. You know, my favorite setting to interact with people on these questions is Starbucks. And I hope I don't step on any theological toes by mentioning this next setting. I also like to share a beer in a bar, right? Go in, sit down, and talk and say, you know, let's talk about this evidence. And treat that person in a way that reflects how you yourself would like to be treated in a similar context. You know, the evidence is very powerful, and the Holy Spirit doesn't need any help from us in the sense of using these tools of ridicule or polemic or what we would naturally resort to sort of in if we were, you know, anxious. I think that going into that kind of situation with a prayerful attitude and saying the truth is so powerful that I just need to present it and interact with this person and treat them with love and respect, you know, that's how I would like to be treated. And that's I think, a good rule of thumb. And it's far more likely to be persuasive in the long run than attacking someone and ridiculing their position.
There's something else I was thinking about as a result of an interaction I had with one of my doctors. I have mantle cell lymphoma, and my doctor is an expert in that particular field. She happens also to be an atheist.
Wow.
And so we've had some discussions over time, and the other day she said to me, you know, you called yourself a layperson when it comes to mantle cell lymphoma, and certainly you are. But I'm a layperson when it comes to this whole notion of origins. So I've never really spent time examining that. So it's a field that hopefully sometime or other I'll be able to get into. And I thought that was interesting because oftentimes we think that because we know something in a particular field, we know a lot about everything, but it's simply not true. We all have limited time and space to learn, and therefore we know a very small sliver of what could be known. And I think once we get that in our heads, we treat people with a whole lot more dignity and respect, as opposed to saying, how could they be so dumb to believe this or that?
That's right. Recognizing that all of us outside our narrow sphere of expertise, all of us are lay people, all of us can learn. And, you know, often when I'm in a discussion, one-on-one or in a small group, the best posture I can adopt is that of a Socratic questioner, asking open-ended questions that encourage my interlocutors to bring things out of their knowledge store. And I'll tell you, when I go to lecture, I got my PowerPoint ready, right? I know what I'm going to say. For me, the really meaningful part of the evening is the Q&A, because then I get to hear from the audience what was persuasive, what was compelling, what didn't they understand, what questions did they have. And I tell them that going in, standing up at the lectern, I say, I'm going to talk, you know, 40 minutes, and then I want to hear from you guys. And I'll tell you, Hank, that's when the real work gets done. It's in that conversation back and forth between audience and speaker, or one-on-one, again, in a Starbucks setting, patiently listening, and God honors that.
There's sort of a stereotype in the world today, and I encounter it all the time. You have elites and luminaries who, to this very day, will say, if you question the Darwinian paradigm, then you are hostile to reason. You hear this in top political circles. You hear this certainly in the academy, this idea that if you, even for a moment, think about another aspect of this, and that's global warming.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Jay Richards, a colleague of yours at the Discovery Institute, I mean, he's saying, look, you have to learn how to ask the right questions in the right sequence. And once you do that, you can come to a conclusion. But there shouldn't be a hostility that you start out with, which says that anyone who denies this paradigm is denying settled science.
Yes. The problem is questioning something like neo-Darwinian evolution is a cultural flag. I wish I could think of a good metaphor. It's like an indicator that says this person is likely to be opposed to me if me happens to be someone who is on the political left or in a position of cultural authority where the standing of the neo-Darwinian theory really matters and so forth. And what happens is an unfortunate kind of chain of events. I've seen it over and over in different university settings when I've lectured. Very bright people, you know, PhD level training, college professors, their brain shuts down when you ask certain questions. So one of the challenges I face is to frame the question in such a way that their curiosity is engaged before the shutdown, right? So they want to keep asking questions and saying, well, what if it wasn't true? How would the world look if it wasn't true? And the problem is once that brain shutdown occurs, it's over. You might as well call a halt to the evening. And it's because I think evolution, unlike any other scientific theory, is the theory about us. It's about where we came from, what our origins are, where our moral sense came from. And for that reason, it brings a lot of baggage that does not really belong to science or even philosophy. There are all kinds of cultural things that come into play there. So when I'm lecturing, half of my brain is presenting the material and the other half is praying for the presence of the Holy Spirit to make sure that brain shutdown doesn't happen.
I think what you're pointing to is probably something that ought to be underscored in this podcast, and that is ultimately this is not about winning arguments. This is about winning people and having a perspective of eternity, because this is not about a popularity contest. This is not about prosperity. This is not about the size of anyone's platform. At the end of the day, and when you're in touch with your own mortality, as I am at this moment, at the end of the day, the thing that really matters is, what did God think?
That's right. And we are dealing with ultimate questions, and ultimate questions that connect to the eternal destiny of someone's soul. You know, a person who believes that at their death their existence will cease is someone who is really lost to the Christian message. The Christian worldview tells us that what makes us uniquely what we are, each of us individually, is eternal. It will not go away with our physical death. Our physical existence is a tiny, infinitesimally small sliver of our total existence in reality. And once you grasp that truth, then the materialist worldview is hopelessly inadequate, and you have to begin to look for the source of your existence. Who made me? Why am I here? So these existential questions that are so vital to understanding reality end up connected to evolution, and really evolution is foam on the surface of a much deeper sea that has to do with really ultimately spiritual questions.
I think when you think about Darwinian evolution, you have to ultimately think about the consequences of this idea, or what we would call a cosmogenic myth.
Mm-hmm.
You think about the sovereignty of self replacing the sovereignty of God. You get rid of God, you're no longer accountable. You think about the sexual revolution, or you think about survival of the fittest. All of these are grave consequences of an idea. So ideas have consequences, and therefore this idea, perhaps more than any other, has to be challenged.
You know, it's terrifying, fascinating in one sense, but terrifying in another, to look at the history of 20th century figures like Joseph Stalin. There's very good evidence that as a young man in the seminary in Georgia, he was a seminary student, Russian Orthodox seminary, he read Darwin and went around saying to his classmates, the priests are lying to us. You know, the book of Genesis isn't true, and this book, this Origin of Species, has the real story of our existence. In both the First and Second World War in Germany, the influence of evolutionary thinking on the culture at large was very strong, and they had a might makes right view, where the most powerful agents, the most powerful forces in a society, were entitled to dominate the others because that was the way of nature. I've often told people the last person you want to live next door to is a perfectly consistent materialist, because they'll steal your car, they'll break into your house, they will hold that might makes right view. Now, many evolutionary biologists, thank goodness, are wildly inconsistent on this point. They don't steal your car. They don't break into your house because they don't hold that worldview. But that worldview of might makes right flows directly from an evolutionary understanding of reality. So you're right. Ideas do have consequences, and false ideas have bad consequences.
We're talking about Huxley. I mean, the whole Huxley clan we could talk about and spend a whole podcast on that. But you think about consequences with respect to Huxley. Huxley believed that eugenics was something that we ought to consider very, very carefully. He had these eugenic ambitions, the idea that if you were a hemophiliac, or if you were a Down syndrome child, before the term was even coined, if you in some way were an inferior person, you were infecting the gene pool with your less fit genes, and as a result of that, you were inhibiting the process of evolution, and therefore something needed to be done. And that something that needed to be done wasn't just carried out in the German death camps, but it was carried out in the United States of America. I was talking to someone the other day about the fact that in North Carolina, where I live, we're still paying reparations over the consequence of eugenics, where people were sterilized, where people were thought to be inferior because they're black or a Jew or had some kind of disease. So this is another dramatic consequence of the evolutionary paradigm.
Yes. In fact, our own Supreme Court ruled in a case, three generations of idiots are enough, right? That the involuntary sterilization of people by the government was permitted. And it's a sobering realization when you look at Nazi Germany. They looked with approval on what we had already been doing here in the United States for decades, under the influence of eugenic thinking, where premise was we need to give evolution some help. We need to give the process of evolution some help. These obviously unfit, lesser people should not be allowed to contribute to the gene pool, so we're just going to speed up the evolutionary process and stop them from doing that. And I'll tell you what really ended the eugenic enterprise in the United States was the Holocaust, because we saw unmistakably the consequences of taking the levers of biology into our own hands, meaning Homo sapiens or human beings. And this is yet another example that ideas do have consequences, and practical public policy that's flowing from an erroneous worldview will have devastating consequences for the health of a culture at large.
You think about today as well, the people that continue to perpetrate mythology, they become cultural icons and heroes. They become cult figures in some way. The Dover case is a classic case in point, where intelligent design is no longer allowed because you can't have the free exchange of ideas. So you have a judge that becomes this cult figure after cobbling together information from the ACLU, yeah, and he even cobbles it together with all their mistakes, their errors, so he hasn't done his own work. And he becomes this huge, huge icon, picture on Time magazine. He's quoted by the New York Times. He's a hero. And so there seems to be a real incentive for people like Bill Nye, the science guy, or Neil deGrasse Tyson, celebrity scientists, not really to think through their paradigms, but simply to mouth old paradigms that have already been exploded.
Yeah, it's an unhappy consequence of our celebrity culture. But, you know, it's nothing new. I mean, you open the Old Testament and you see one popular false prophet after another, right? They tickled the ears of the audience. They said things that their audience wanted to hear. But you know what? We don't have their writings. We don't have their prophecies. History and reality have swept that away. What survives? What survives is Jeremiah. What survives is Elisha and Elijah and Samuel and the prophets who spoke the truth. The truth has longevity. The truth has strength and power. And momentary cultural popularity can get you on, The Daily Show or in some other popular venue, but it's like chaff. The wind just blows it away. So I take what you're saying, but I take it with a grain of salt, and I recognize that what's enduring and that what will survive in the long run is the truth, even though at any given moment in our society, and I look at myself in a mirror when I say this, I'm not pointing a finger, I recognize that I'm as susceptible to having my ears tickled as anybody else. What's popular at any given moment will be swept away by reality itself. So I try to take the long view. Open up the Old Testament and see the false prophets had huge followings. Nobody remembers them, and certainly nobody reads anything that they said or wrote.
Just as you were talking, I was thinking about the prophet Jeremiah. He was saying, do not listen to what the prophets are prophesying to you. They fill you with false hopes. They speak visions from their own minds, not from the mouth of the Lord. And he was the quintessential example of a persecuted prophet. I mean, Yep. He was beat. He was humiliated. He was thrown into a well. And as you say, if you take the long view, his words survive to this day, whereas the false prophets have a hard time thinking of their names in the present. You know, I was thinking about someone from the past, Hermann Mueller.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1946 or thereabouts for a
geneticist
breakthrough.
Yes.
Yeah, on how X-rays affected fruit flies. And today, all attempts to speed up evolution by X-rays have been abandoned. But he won a Nobel Peace Prize. And these kinds of stories keep getting perpetuated because of the luminaries and because of the awards, because of the status that they have achieved.
Yeah, it's interesting when you mention Mueller. What, in fact, he discovered was that fruit flies do not like to be exposed to X-rays. What happened, you know, the living system itself will talk back to you. I'm actually going to be lecturing about this in Seattle next week to a group of summer seminar students. When you subject fruit flies or frogs or chickens, chicks, actually eggs, to ionizing radiation or to, you know, strong chemicals, those systems don't like it, because they have a natural target towards which they're heading as they develop. Give a fruit fly embryo half a chance, it wants to turn into a fruit fly. It doesn't want to evolve into something else. So in a sense, Mueller and other people like him learned something that now is in our biology textbook. It's just that the lesson isn't really understood. Living things don't want to evolve, and certainly if they're animals, that's the very last thing they want to do.
One of the things that I find maybe strange in some sense, you have colleagues, I'm not going to mention any names, but there are people today that continue to believe what I would consider a myth, the myth of Darwin's tree of life. It seems that that tree of life has been uprooted, and yet this myth seems to be universally accepted within the evolutionary community, and even to some degree within the community of people who question the whole notion that natural selection of random variations is the explanation for everything.
Let me speak to that very briefly. I do have colleagues who accept that single tree picture, but they do so provisionally. In other words, they want their listeners, their readers, to focus like a laser on the process of evolution. For instance, does the mechanism of natural selection actually work? And their view is, look, if I ask people to question natural selection and the tree of life, I'll never gain a hearing. So they kind of bracket the tree of life question and say, look, I'm going to put that to one side, really not essential to the case I'm making. I want you, my reader, to focus on natural selection. Does it really do what Darwin thought it could? And some of these colleagues have told me, look, Paul, if the tree of life, Darwin's single tree picture, if that turned out not to be true, wouldn't bother me in the least. So it's very much a pragmatic kind of chess player move. You can have my bishop, you can have my rook, I'm going for your king, right, as they see it. Now, in the evolutionary community itself, actually common dissent, that single tree picture is in real trouble. Very, very senior, I'm talking National Academy of Science level biologists, are now saying we don't believe it. We don't buy it. Craig Venter, who sequenced his own DNA, he was in a competition with the U.S. government to get the first complete human genome. In 2007, so this is 10 years ago, Craig Venter said, I don't think there ever was a single tree of life. I think there must have been thousands of starting points. So in the face of genomic data that no one expected, the genetic diversity of life on this planet is vastly greater than anyone realized. A lot of these guys, for reasons unrelated to the intelligent design debate, are saying, you know what, there probably wasn't ever a single tree of life. So this is a topic very close to my heart. I wrote about it at Chicago. I continue to work on it now 20 years later. And I expect in the next decade, we're going to see radical shifts within evolutionary theory itself, where people say we have to come up with a different history. Darwin was wrong. If you had told me as a graduate student that this would be happening, I simply wouldn't have believed it. But science doesn't stand still, and DNA sequencing has really shaken up the tree of life picture.
You know, I really want to park on this for a moment, because what you have just done is modeled the very thing that I was talking about at the opening of the podcast. You had every opportunity, especially given your specialization, to say that anyone who would hold to this idea of Darwin's Tree of Life has to be an obscurantist that lost their brain somewhere in the narthex of a classroom. But instead, what you did was you likened this to a chess game. I want you to expand on this. I mean, this is an art that has to be learned, because through what you just did, you ended up creating an atmosphere that does not repel.
Well, you know, look, to me, I'm a fallibilist with respect to science, with respect to human knowledge. I think, you know, even the greatest scientists, my heroes, like Kepler, Newton, Boyle, coming towards the present, Francis Crick, one of the co-discoverers of the molecular structure of DNA, they all made spectacular mistakes in their work. Incorrect predictions, wrong theories. If you're afraid of being wrong, don't say anything. And I'll be blunt. The men in the listening audience will know what I'm talking about. You jump into a really cold swimming pool, and whoop, up they go into your body cavity, and in some cases, they never come back down. Okay? So if you're afraid of being wrong, get out of science. Don't do that. So I'm a fallibilist. I know I'm going to make mistakes. So again, going back to something I said earlier, I want the person I'm talking to, and I want to treat them this way, extend them the grace of saying, you know what, maybe you're wrong about that. All right, big deal. Let's keep the conversation going, and we'll focus on this particular issue, and we can bracket these other ones. Come back to those later. It just makes life a lot more easy.
Although, you know, there are some things that have to drive you crazy. I mean, I'm thinking about the icons of evolution, you know, where these same stories get perpetuated ad nauseum, ad infinitum, you know, the peppered moth, the bacterial resistance to antibiotics, and you could probably come up with a whole list, but these stories get recycled over and over again as though somehow or other this proves macroevolution.
You know, it's human nature. It's hard to write a textbook, a biology textbook. So what do? You get the old biology textbook off the shelf, and you say, which of these icons, which of these stories can I recycle for another round? You know, and particularly the illustrations. You know, it's laborious to put together a good scientific illustration. So you just take the one that people used before. And actually, one of my colleagues at Discovery Institute, Jonathan Wells, has just come out with a new book called Zombie Science, where he revisits the icons that he treated now 17 years ago in his classic Icons of Evolution, plus six new ones. Like, there's this icon that the vertebrate retina, the structure of the vertebrate retina is badly engineered because the photoreceptors face away from incoming light. And as a consequence, we have a blind spot because all the nerves have to come out, be bundled together at the point where the blind spot is. That forms the optic nerve, which then goes off to the brain. Jonathan looks at that and he says, baloney, there's very good functional reasons for the photoreceptors to be oriented as they are. But Hank, I completely agree. You think, oh, I heard that one before. I heard that when I was an eighth grader, that the peppered moth proves whatever, you know. And I guess the thing to be optimistic about is the wheels of science grind very slowly, but they do turn. And just today, in fact, I was doing research on something, and I saw that many of these icons are now coming out of textbooks because people are embarrassed. You know, they're like, I'm not going to put that in again. I know there's problems with that story. That's coming out. So I tend to be a kind of reflexive optimist, and I look for the things that encourage me because the world is discouraging enough all on its own.
You know, I want to talk for a moment about a colleague of yours, Mike Behe,
yeah.
A new film out called Revolutionary, and it's available through our ministry to people that support the ministry. But Mike Behe has this uncanny ability to take the very complex and make it simple and transferable. So his famous Darwin's Black Box, he used a mousetrap.
Right.
And then there was a whole cottage industry that spun out of control trying to explain how the mousetrap illustration simply was sophomoric.
Yeah.
And then he comes up with the flagellum, and he uses that as an example. He likens it to an outboard motor. But that seems to be genius to me, because those kinds of things are things that the average person that can't understand the terminology can immediately recognize the brilliance of the wisdom. I mean, the motor simply doesn't work without a propeller. And he can get that. I think these are some of the brilliant breakthroughs by which this whole edifice, this giant, colossal behemoth, can end up dying or becoming extinct.
I think you're right. And I had the privilege of watching that book, Darwin's Black Box, go from manuscript chapters all the way to the published volume. And you know, it's in print today, 20 years later, 21 now. It will be in print 20 years from now. It's the kind of book that publishers love. It's always on their backlist. It's always in bookstores. It's a classic. And I think you put your finger on the very reason that it has that longevity, and that is that Mike has the gift of taking a complex subject, you know, and translating into everyday terms, and then making those everyday terms work for the reader. The reader can go out and say, well, I see irreducible complexity here. That's, you know, it's Mike's idea that a complex function needs multiple independent parts, all jointly present. I think that books like that, or like Phil Johnson's Darwin on Trial, have changed careers. I know biologists who were tenured, safe in their positions, accepting Darwinian theory, and those books radically shifted their perspective. So it's a medium, this medium of a well-written, entertaining, persuasive book that ends up being very, very fruitful for intelligent design proponents.
It's kind of cool, too, because it shows you the power of one. I mean, you know, Mike probably as well as anybody. I mean, he's a reluctant hero. He's a reluctant revolutionary. I mean, the revolution found him, as it were.
Yes.
And, you know, he has certainly taken this and been faithful to the revolution that has found. But the power of one, I mean, if someone is willing to say the emperor has no clothes, that can cause a revolution, and oftentimes you're not expecting it.
You're not expecting it. And there is something about the dynamics of crowds. And science, like any other human enterprise, is made up of crowds. It's populations of people. And for many scientists, the safe place to be is in the center of the herd, right? You try to get to the warm, comfortable center of the herd where you're well-funded and you're not at any risk of getting in trouble. Well, if everyone tried to get to the center of the herd, you can model that geometrically. There's going to be no movement. Everyone's going to be trying to get to that center position. And it takes someone, as Mike said to me once, he said, I'm just a tough Irishman, Paul, with the courage to step out of the herd, walk a little distance away, and speak back to the rest of the herd and say, hey, guys, you're going over a cliff, right? And the safe place to be may be in the center, but the center's going to go over the cliff like everybody else. You got to change direction. You know, Mike has paid a cost personally for the things that he's said, the things that he's written. But what I love about him is he has been given the gift of courage and will continue till his career ends saying things that he believes are true and that need to be heard, come what may. And that's why, like, I compare, you know, I've talked to Mike about this, you know, again, on the Old Testament model of the false prophets may be more popular, but the things that endure are the things that tap into that truth.
Kind of interesting when your own university has to put a disclaimer out about a professor.
You know what? He wears that like a badge of pride. You go back and you look at the history of science, and there are many episodes where the courageous person was decried. My wife and I, just a couple of months ago, visited Panama. Our older daughter was doing research there, and before we went down, I read a book about the building of the canal. The French tried, and they lost tens of thousands of people. Whole families would die of yellow fever and malaria. And an American scientist said, I think the problem is there's too much standing water. There's too much standing water in Panama. Mosquitoes lay their larvae in standing water. We need to get rid of these pools. The French had built these reflecting pools all over the place because they thought they were pretty. He was ridiculed. In, like, you know, leading American newspapers said, what an idiot. it's not a problem. It's bad air. You know, it's not standing water at all. Well, he was right, but he had to pay a cost because of the social dynamic. You know, you got to step out of that herd, speak the truth, and then you may pay a price. It turns out he was right. And, you know, I must admit I was a little worried going down there because you can still get yellow fever in certain parts of Panama, but I didn't get it.
You know, I don't want to get too far into the weeds, but, you know, one of the common narratives today seems to be the universality of the genetic code. But obviously, by all accounts, this seems to be a gargantuan fraud or certainly gargantuan fiction.
The genetic code is no longer universal, and it hasn't been for over, I'm not very good at math, what's 1985 to today? That's quite a span.
I was going to figure it out. The first thing I thought of is I'm not very good at math either, but I mean, this is
it's a little
over 30 years.
Yeah, and what's so interesting is prior to the discovery of the genetic code, or the belief that it was universal, there were strong predictions in the scientific literature based on evolution that if there is a code, it should be universal. So in 1963, a pair of scientists in the journal Science predicted if there's a genetic code, it'll be the same in every living thing. And they said the reason for that is the code is so fundamental to the biology of any cell that you can't change it because you'll affect every protein in that organism. Well, now there are so many different codes that the NCBI, the National Center for Biotechnology Information, maintains a web page where you have to go look up the code for your particular study group because it may be using a code other than the universal code. So this is a fascinating episode in how science handles anomalies, how it handles observations that don't fit with theory. And I think you can go through molecular biology and find one case after another where evolution, Darwin's tree, that is, predicted a certain outcome. It didn't come to pass, and then how do biologists respond to that? And some of them, as I said earlier, some of them have said, you know what, there never was a single tree. And they're trying other patterns now to represent the history of life.
Now, I'm reading a book. It's by Tom Bethel, and I just find the book absolutely delicious. I mean,
he's a wonderful writer.
Oh, he's just phenomenal. The book is titled Darwin's House of Cards. And in that book, he points out that Darwinism was once a well-fortified castle. It had elaborate towers, and it had moats and battlements and the like. And it stayed in that condition for over 100 years. But today, it more closely resembles a house of cards, to with the title of the book itself, a house of cards that's built out of flimsy icons rather than hard evidence, and it's liable to blow away with the slightest breeze. What's your perception of what is going to happen in the next 5-10 years? Obviously, I'm asking you to be a prophet, but do you think that the whole edifice of evolution is ready for a final fall?
Let me draw a parallel with what happened to the Soviet Union. I remember as a kid, I was working on a farm in North Dakota. I didn't have anything to do in the evenings, and I was reading the Gulag Archipelago. So this is the 1974, the year Nixon resigned, right? And it was clear that Solzhenitsyn knew that this system could not last. The question was, how long would it take for it to go away? But when I was a teenager, I thought we would always have the Soviet system, that it was impregnable, that it had this internal system of control that just couldn't be broken. And you know, Hank, it collapsed from within, and it collapsed from within overnight. And what happened was people suddenly realized nobody believes this. Nobody believes this Marxist-Leninist crap that we've been putting out all these years. And they looked over their shoulders and they realized other people didn't believe it. And it just, boom, it came down. From 89 to 91, the whole Eastern Bloc and then the Soviet Union itself just collapsed. But there was a lag. There was a lag from the time that someone like Solzhenitsyn saw the problem until the actual collapse. So it's risky to be a prophet, but let me put it this way. I think evolutionary theory right now is in a position akin to that of the Soviet Union in the 70s, where the system still is kind of rolling on, but internally there's a great deal of doubt about the cohesiveness of the theory, about the central concepts of the theory. And I think what happens is you get this trigger point where people look around themselves and they say, you know what, I don't believe this and nobody else does either. I'm ready to be surprised. And as I said earlier, if you had told me when I was a graduate student in the mid-90s that common descent would be up for grabs, I would have laughed. I just would not have believed it. So I think the time of opportunity for the intelligent design research community is really now. I don't want to end on a sobering thought, but let me offer this. If you look at ancient Israel, they were not just surrounded by naturalists or materialists. They were surrounded by idolaters. And we need to be clear-eyed about the fallenness of human beings and their desire to erect any idol other than the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So I try to tell people, yes, root for the overthrow of Darwinian theory, but recognize that human perversity is such that the larger community may adopt an idol that you will like even less than Darwinism. And sadly, intelligent design as a generic notion can be hijacked. You can have plenty of designers who are not the God of the Bible. So just a word of warning to listeners, recognize that the collapse of one theory does not mean that sweetness and light will prevail. I think that's really not a biblical expectation. I hate to sound negative, but I want to be realistic.
I'm also thinking about maybe a macro issue here. I was thinking as you're speaking about the words of Lee Kuan Yew, who is the father of Singapore.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of an interesting story in that he looked to Cambodia when Cambodia was essentially a first world country as the prototype for what Singapore could be.
Mm-hmm.
Founded Singapore in 1965, ceded from Malaysia. And today, Singapore is the envy of the world. Cambodia is a third world country at best, and Singapore is a first world country. But the reason I bring that up in terms of context is Lee Kuan Yew said all civilization is essentially fragile. And I wonder what you have to say about Western civilization today, because it seems like we are sowing the seeds of our own demise internally. I have a hard time, honestly, going home and watching the news today. And it's not so much because news is negative. It is because the narrative is so deflective to the continuation of Western civilization.
I think what you say is true, and it is discouraging in one sense. In another sense, it confirms my understanding of reality, that I see reality through a biblical lens. And again, I often tell students that you can think of the moral universe that's put forward in the Christian worldview as a kind of owner's manual, right? So your owner's manual in your Honda Civic tells you, you got to change the oil. You want this thing to run properly, you've got to change the oil every 3,000 miles. Now, you can neglect that, but you'll pay a consequence. And the moral realities of human existence are as real, as perfectly real as the law of gravity. And our culture, to the degree that it departs from that, says, well, you know what, we're not going to change the oil, or we're going to put in something else other than oil. And I think what God says to a culture like that is, okay, you want to do that, I've given you the freedom to act as you wish, but you're going to pay a consequence. It's inevitable. So what frightens me is the sense that when the moral compass is gone, the society will continue to function, but it's going to break down. And when that breakdown comes, my prayer is, God, give me the courage to do the right thing at the right time. I grew up hearing stories about Corrie ten Boom, and she and her family paid a consequence for hiding Jews in their home in the Netherlands. I want, and I hope every listener should want, the courage of Corrie ten Boom to do the right thing at the right time, whatever the consequences, and God honors that. But again, Hank, I have to tell you, in my own devotional life, in my own work, I draw on the promises of Scripture for God's ultimate victory, because then I can be cheerful. Then I can go about my work with a sense of, yes, I'm in His plan, and I don't have to be, frankly, I don't turn on the news, but when I do hear it and it discourages me, I rebuke that feeling within myself and I say, God, I know you have a plan and your plan is for your ultimate victory. Please cement me, keep me safe in that, and then I can be cheerful and happy about doing my work.
So the takeaway is that it's not about winning or losing, it's being faithful.
Amen. And God himself knows what his plan is, and he has a plan for each of us. And his victory is promised in Scripture, crystal clear, promised in Scripture, and we just need to rest in that. If we do, he'll take care of us.
At the end of a podcast, I don't want to open another can of worms, but I have to ask you about Colin Paterson, who essentially no longer, at least when you listen to him speak, no longer believes in evolution as a result of the evidence that he sees in the natural world, but seems to believe in evolution as a faith proposition.
I think that's true for many evolutionary biologists, and the reason they hold that view is the alternative looks to them like magic. If the alternative is magic, then even a defective theory is better than no theory at all. So Colin Paterson was an inspiration to me as a student because of the things that he said and wrote in a very candid way about the shortcomings of standard theory. But ultimately, every investigator is faced with a choice. In the light of the evidence, which way are you going to go? And one of the challenges, probably the main challenge faced by the intelligent design research community, is to represent biology in such a way that someone can say, you know what, I'm going to get out of the herd. I'm going to take all the courage I can muster and break away from this herd and try this other way of understanding reality, understanding biology. And the history of science shows that this is possible. You know, over and over, the prevailing theory goes down and it's shoved off the side of the road. So, yeah, Paterson, remarkable person, but again, faced with that ultimate choice, it ceases to be something that's based on evidence. It becomes a faith commitment, where faith is used as a pejorative, which, by the way, Christians should never do. Our faith is a gift of the Holy Spirit. We should never turn that noun into a pejorative.
You know, so many millennials, Paul, listen into these podcasts, and I suppose, as it were, you can picture them listening into what you're saying, and perhaps you can speak directly to them. I mean, you work in the academic field, you work in the university, you teach students, you teach millennials. This whole notion that you just talked about of identifying yourself as someone separate from the herd as opposed to following the herd mentality, it's a very, very difficult thing to do. I was thinking about my own kids and how difficult it was for some of my kids to experience secular university, because not only do you have the professors as sort of antagonists to your worldview, but your peers. So it becomes very, very difficult for these kids going into universities to stand away from the herd, to maintain their integrity, their identity as people that are not going to buy into groupthink, that are going to think for themselves and pay the consequences if there are consequences.
It's hard. And the best advice I ever received from my PhD advisor at Chicago was, in my first year there, he said to me, knowing my views, he said, Paul, you're going to have to be a little better at evolutionary theory than everybody else in the program. He said, that's not fair, but that's reality. And the gist of his advice was, be such a good student of the prevailing view. In other words, know it backwards and forwards. You will earn the right to dissent because people will respect you. They'll say, well, look, you know the main theory and you know its weaknesses and you know it well. And you look at biblical figures like Daniel, respected by the Babylonian culture for his wisdom. Case after case of prophets and patriarchs, biblical figures, who were first-rate students, first-rate scholars in their discipline, so to speak, and yet they dissented from the mainstream culture. You know, when I was in Vacation Bible School as a kid, we had a song, Dare to Be a Daniel. And it always stuck with me because, you know, these guys were not winning popularity contests, yet the things that they said, the prophecies, the wisdom that they imparted endured. So I would, you know, I would encourage a student, do the best you can, be loving and kind and patient, but trust in God that he'll take care of you and watch over your career. Yes, you may pay costs, but the costs overall will be very, very small to the personal cost you'll pay if you go with the herd.
This is something that has nothing to do with anything other than my own just love for Illustra Media. Lad Allen and the folks at Illustra Media, I think, have made such a transcendent difference, and you have been the primary figure in most of these films. I just wonder if you might, again, this has nothing to do with me or ministry, but I just feel like what they have done has been so monumental. I wonder if you could put a little plug in for friends at Illustra.
I sure will. They have begun a new venture, a web-based archive of short, talking YouTube-length, 4 to 5 minute excerpts from their whole body of work, not just their films on intelligent design, but their films on biblical prophecy, their films on sacred music, and so forth. It's called the John 1010 Project. So if the listeners go to Google and put in John, J-O-H-N, 1010, they'll call up this beautiful archive. The reality is the DVD market is going away. When people want to watch a movie today, it's overwhelmingly likely that they're going to stream it. So Illustra is trying to shift to a more web-based streaming platform for their material, but you can get excerpts from their movies free of charge at the John 1010 site, and the intelligent design film tank that you love are also available there.
That's cool. Hey, well, we love you and have appreciated you.
I love being on.
You have made such a contribution over the years in so many different venues and so many different places. And most of all, I appreciate the manner in which you conduct yourself. I think it's a lesson for all apologists. I mean, I always find a danger in the apologetics community because, as I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, once you garner a little bit of knowledge, you can start trying to win arguments instead of winning people. And you've modeled precisely the opposite. But I'm grateful for you spending this time, not only on our broadcast, but for this podcast as well.
You're certainly welcome. And please know that I'm praying for your health situation and thinking about the ministry that you guys are involved in.
Thank you so much, Paul. Dr. Paul Nelson, again, he's a PhD, philosophy of biology from the University of Chicago. He's currently a fellow of the Discovery Institute. He's a professor in the Master of Arts program in science and religion at Biola. And he's made contributions to Illustra Media that will continue touching lives for generations to come if the Lord tarries. And I want to thank everybody listening in for joining me for another episode of Hank Unplugged. This is the podcast that gets me out of the studio and into the study, so to speak. It's less didactic. It's more lean-back conversational. And I'm bringing, as I have today, some of the brightest, most articulate people on the planet to you as a service to the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. If you like what you're hearing, make sure to give us a rating on iTunes or wherever you consume your favorite podcasts, and share this with your friends. Thanks for tuning in. Look forward to seeing you on another episode of Hank Unplugged.